Please grant it as a hero me as a faint whisper.
I did not hear it all night. I was on the wing, although it must be from a female.
Can my evidence still left to speak,
audible only to the ear of the householder,
seem to me that the beast has ever even heard me.
It simply cannot have heard me, for all that time I kept very quiet, that I dug the experimental trenches. The Burrow, hosted by Andy Resto. Mondays from 3 to 4 p.m. Alternative music, noise things, artist interviews, honest discussions, levity. Because music doesn't need to be fun. On CITR 101.9 FM and CITR.ca.
Gangnam Style.
Gangnam Style. Nor like.
She bangs, she bangs. Oh baby, but she moves, she moves.
I'm talking about a little more like. And a little more like. And also a little more like. And definitely something like. So tune in to Asian Wave 101, playing you the best of Chinese and Korean pop, Wednesdays from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. It's nothing. Take it slow for now. Here I am, here you are. Take it slow.
Hey, 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 what's going on, everyone? Welcome back. Today is Friday, February 5th. I'm Michael Ruffalo.
And I'm Eva Yuguen Senge. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to the listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening, everyone. It is 5:15 p.m., and it's time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. We have a piece on the UBC faculty protests of the Board of Governors produced by News 101 correspondents Brent Holmes and Leo Coelho.
Following that, we have News 101 co-director Emily Blake's interview with Dr. John Olive, founder and lead investigator of UBC's Men's Health Research Program. He discusses a new study about men and mental health.
We also have a new segment from News 101 correspondent Eva Yuguen Senge with her interview with UBC researcher Dr. Julian Davies about BC First Nations clay that is killing untreatable bacteria.
Up first, we have News 101 financial reporter Alex Norman's weekly financial report. To finish off tonight's episode, we have an episode of Talking Radical Radio with Scott Nye, Queers Against Gentrification. Nye speaks with members of Queer Trans Community Defense, a group that is organizing against gentrification in Toronto's Downtown East neighborhood.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, UBC faculty protests Board of Governors meeting. Tuesday afternoon, a group of protesters gathered outside the Robert H. Lee Alumni Center to demand greater transparency from the Board of Governors. The protest, organized by faculty, demanded the Board of Governors stop holding secret, undocumented meetings and called for an external review. UBC Faculty Association President Mark McLean addressed the crowd studying, saying, quote, "What we've seen with the resignation of Gupta and the handling of only a little is only a little glimpse of what is really going on. In order to enable the good governance of this university, we need significant change." After protesters filed inside the building, they disrupted the ongoing Board of Governors meeting. As a result, the board was forced to suspend their meeting and allowed 20 protesters into the room. Computer science professor Alan Mackworth said, quote, "I'm just concerned about governance at this university, that it appears that the board is acting in a way that's undocumented and really unjust." The protest comes days after the release of unredacted documents concerning the resignation of former UBC president Arvind Gupta. UBC Vice President of External Relations, Philip Steenkamp, responded to the protest saying the board is, quote, "committed to hearing the views of all members of the university community and has an ongoing commitment to evaluation, reviewing best practices and continuous improvement."
In local news, the first Indigenous woman elected to BC legislator. Melanie Mark won Tuesday's by-election with 61% of the vote, securing an NDP seat in Vancouver Mount Pleasant. Mark, who worked with the Office of the BC Representative for Children and Youth for 8 years, is Cree, Gixtun, Nisqua, and Ojibwe. Mark said of her victory, quote, "I'm so proud to be here. It's the most exhilarating journey that I've ever been on." She made a traditional entrance at Heritage Mall on Main Street, preceded by dancing, singing, and drumming. Scott Clark, Executive Director of Aboriginal Life in Vancouver Enhancement, said of the historic victory, quote, "It's huge because the riding has the largest number of Indigenous people in the province." During her campaign, Mark stressed the need for greater measures to protect vulnerable children and adults. She also called on the ruling Liberals to implement a poverty reduction plan, develop an affordable housing strategy, and halt rising medical service plan costs and BC Hydro rates. The by-election was to fill the seat left vacant by former NDP MLA Jenny Kwan, who is now the MP in Vancouver East. Another by-election in Coquitlam Burke Mountain was won by the NDP's Jody Wickens. The NDP now holds 35 of 85 seats in the legislature.
In national news, the John Gomeshi trial begins in Toronto. Monday was the first day of former CBC radio host John Gomeshi's sexual assault trial. Gomeshi is charged with 4 counts of sexual assault and 1 count of overcoming resistance by choking. He is pleading not guilty to all counts. The charges come from complaints made by 3 women, with the alleged incidents taking place in 2002 and 2003. 2 of the women's identities are protected under a publication ban. Actress and Royal Canadian Air Force Captain Lucy Decouter went public with her story last year. The trial is by judge only and is being heard by Judge William Horkins. One woman, who alleges she was sexually assaulted twice by Gomeshi, testifies on the first day of trial. However, she was aggressively challenged by defense lawyer Marie Henin, who highlighted inconsistencies between her sworn testimony and earlier statements made to the police and media. Toronto lawyer and former Crown attorney Daniel Lerner says in sexual assault trials, verdicts often come down to determining if the accusers are believable. Lerner said of Gomeshi's defenses, quote, "They're probably not presenting an alternative version. Instead, it seems the defense strategy is to show that the evidence being called by the Crown is of such low reliability or credibility that there's not enough to prove that this happened beyond a reasonable doubt." The trial has sparked discussion about how sexual assault cases are handled by the judicial system. Nicole Peach, coordinator of the Ontario Coalition of Rape Crisis Centres, said, quote, "What you'll see in this court case is a reflection of what survivors go through any time they go to court." She noted that complaints are grilled about minute details, while the accused often don't take the stand to face the same scrutiny. A 2013 Globe and Mail article states that 90% of sexual assaults go unreported, and those that are reported, the conviction rate is only 1 in 4. Amanda Dale, executive court director of the Barbara Schleifer Commemorative Clinic, said, quote, "I want people to remember that this is not entertainment television. This is people's lives, shattered by experiences that they are trying to have common good, the common good weigh in on." Gomeshi will face another charge of sexual assault in a separate trial in June.
In international news, Black Lives Matter activists run for Baltimore mayor. DeRay McKesson is the first Black Lives Matter activist who has directly entered politics. McKesson told the Baltimore Sun, quote, "Baltimore is a city of promise and possibility. We can't rely on traditional pathways to politics and the traditional politicians who walk those paths if we want transformational change." He is the 13th and final candidate to join the primary race. McKesson is a Baltimore native and former public school administrator who gained international attention during the protests in Ferguson after the police shooting of Michael Brown. He has played a large role in the Black Lives Matter movement, including being active on Twitter and engaging in protests across the U.S. He is also part of a team called Campaign Zero, which aims to end police killings in America through increased community oversight of police and limited use of force. Baltimore has been a key city battling the issue of racism in America's justice system since Freddie Gray was killed by police in April 2015.
All right, those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Ever had a hankering to ski the world-famous slopes of
Whistler?
Boy, do we have great news for you. Escape the city in one of Zipcar's many mountain-ready vehicles. Plus, get $30 back in free driving credit when you tweet a selfie on the slopes at Zipcar Vancouver. Zipcar, wheels when you want them.
Open Media International is a non-profit, non-partisan organization working towards informed, citizen-driven internet policy. Open Media believes in keeping the internet uncensored, open, innovative, secure, and providing universal access to fast and affordable networks. If you would like Open Media to keep campaigning for citizens and internet policy, you can donate to them at openmedia.org or openmedia.ca. You can also find them on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Google+.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Right now, we have a piece on the UBC faculty protest of the Board of Governors produced by News 101 correspondents Brent Holmes and Leonardo Coelho.
I am very proud to see all of you out here today. I'm particularly proud that this is a rally that has been organized by a grassroots group of faculty who have had enough of the kind of bad governance that goes on at this university. I think that what we've seen with the resignation and the handling of it is only a little glimpse at what is really going on. It is very clear from our management of the academic freedom case involving Professor Berdahl that this board has no processes for managing complaints against the members of the board, for example. Nothing is written. This is a place in which we have no procedures written down for anyone to challenge or even reference. This is a place where we have secret meetings that we don't even record the existence of, let alone any motions out of. How is that open and transparent governance of the university?
That was Professor Bruce Rusk speaking to a crowd of over 100 faculty and students outside of the Robert H. Lee Alumni Center. Protesters crashed a Board of Governors meeting on Tuesday in response to a document leak last week. The leaked documents reveal secret meetings that led to former UBC President Arvind Gupta's resignation. Faculty were demanding an independent review of the Board of Governors to look into what they call a lack of transparency over board member interactions with administration and faculty. Professors turned up in their brightly colored faculty gowns, and the protesters carried cleaning supplies, including bottles of Windex labeled #UBCClean. The protesters, led by Jennifer Berdahl, came up to the room where the Board of Governors was meeting. UBC Insider's Neil Johnson recalls what he heard from inside the meeting.
It was the same as it normally was. They were just moving on to whatever the next agenda item was, which was a presentation on, I guess, an overall research strategy for UBC. Mm-hmm. And so the VP Research got up and started giving his presentation, and everyone kind of was going about their business as if nothing was happening. It was audible once it was clear people were starting to come up the stairs. You could see one or two of them kind of turn their heads back towards the hallway, but they were quickly turned around by other board members, basically saying, you know, pay them no mind. And so even though it was clear what was going on outside, they were still trying to soldier on and get through the presentation that they were receiving. I think it's exactly what I expected from the board. Certainly they stopped the meeting once it became so loud that they couldn't really continue with the presentation. But until then, and only then did they really acknowledge that protesters were there. But before then, they just kind of wanted to pretend like nothing was happening.
A couple faculty members were allowed to speak to the board during the meeting. Afterwards, the protesters eventually filtered out of the tiny area of the Alumni Center's third floor. In an emailed statement, UBC VP External Philip Steinkamp said, quote, "The board, with its representation from students, faculty, staff, and alumni, as well as appointed members, is committed to hearing the views of all members of the university community and has an ongoing commitment to evaluation, reviewing best practices, and continuing improvement." Rusk maintains that faculty and students will need to continue to put pressure on the board if they do not respond to their concerns.
Ideally, they would respond. They would. So our demand was not issued formally in writing, but now the Faculty Association has said much the same thing, and they had already earlier called for a review. They've repeated that call. And ideally, we'll hear from the board and hear in a positive way. I hope, we don't know what goes on in all these higher levels, but I hope that the Provincial Ministry of Advanced Education is paying close attention to this and making sure that all the applicable laws and guidelines are being followed, and is perhaps putting pressure on the university to make sure that that's the case. But if we don't see anything happen, we're just going to have to keep thinking of ways to keep a spotlight on this issue.
One way or the other, it's unlikely that this will be the last time the board hears from the faculty about these issues.
Thank you, Brent and Leo. Now we have News 101 co-director Emily Blake's interview with Dr. John Olive, founder and lead investigator of UBC's Men's Health Research Program on Masculinity and Men's Mental Health.
A recent study from UBC found that men are much harder on themselves when it comes to depression and suicidal thoughts. Dr. John Olive is the lead author of the study, founded by the Movember Foundation. He is a professor at the School of Nursing at UBC and is also the founder and lead investigator of UBC's Men's Health Research Program. His work focuses on masculinity and how it influences men's health behaviors and illness management, and its impact on partners, families, and quality of life. Last week, he also participated in the Terry Project's latest bar talk about toxic masculinity. I spoke with Dr. Olive about the study, masculinity, and how it affects men's health.
Last week, you participated in the Toxic Masculinity panel for the Terry Project bar talk. And I was wondering if you could talk about what is toxic masculinity or how you explain it.
Yeah, well, the panel was really interesting because there was a few variations on it. My sense of it, from my own point of view and from what was said at the panel, is that it's a kind of a performativity, you know, and practices that are negative, that might work against men and definitely work against women and other people around men. So things that result in bad things happening for a bunch of people. So that's how I understood the general kind of take on toxic masculinities. Yeah.
And in the panel, you also talked about your time when you worked in the ER and seeing how this masculinity affected men when they came into the ER.
Yeah, so I think in terms of health, you know, I worked in the emergency room for 20 years, and I would continuously see men coming in, and they would be denying that they had chest pain, yet they'd be kind of clutching their middle chest, and they'd be sweating, and they'd be diaphoretic, and, you know, they're cardinal signs of, you know, oftentimes cardiac problems and things. So it just struck me, you know, very early on that guys kind of just underestimated or denied, you know, pain. And so sometimes it's about not wanting to appear weak, you know, to appearing to be, you know, strong in the face of adversity even. And so, yeah, it was kind of interesting in that way to see guys that just kind of disconnected sometimes from their health or even just denying a problem. And I think we see that a lot in health behaviours outside of the ER.
So going on to the recent study that you were the lead author of, what were sort of the main findings about men and depression?
I think there was a couple. So stigma, we often talk about stigma from being from outside. So when we experience depression or suicidal thoughts, then oftentimes it's society invoking a kind of a stigma on us. And so what was interesting about this particular study was that we polled guys who'd actually had some experience of suicidal thoughts and depression, plus or minus depression. And so their self-stigma about feeling weak, about getting help, about feeling weak if they were known to get help, that was kind of the new and maybe neat finding of this one, is to suggest, well, you know, outside of society, you know, invoking stigma, guys are often pretty tough on themselves. And so it's just interesting because in some ways you have to help the guys come to grips with being a bit different and working their way through it in a strength-based way, yet you also know that they're quite troubled by the idea of admitting anything that might resemble weakness in seeking help. Because oftentimes guys, when they experience depression, you know, will probably need a few strategies. And so that often involves asking people for a little bit of help.
What are some ways to combat that stigma?
Great question. You know, I think men are really influential over other men. So we know that when a guy has the strength to speak up about something that's challenging him and something that works for him in terms of effectively dealing with the depression or depressive symptoms, we know it can be highly influential on other men because it kind of breaks with the, you know, keeping going on with the script about idealised masculinity, about, you know, that somehow it's associated with weakness. So that does help to sort of normalise the idea that it might actually be quite a show of strength to fix a problem and a problem in and of itself and working through. So I think that can be really persuasive in helping guys, you know, kind of work their way through to something in terms of just helping them fix what's going on.
And one of the other things that came up from the study is that social isolation is a real issue for a lot of men.
It is. And so social isolation is the biggest risk factor in suicide. And so men do suicide at 4 times the rate of women. And I'm not setting that up as a competing victim piece at all, but just to say, we know that guys isolate. And I had an interesting chat with someone the other day, and they mentioned that guys can be isolated even when they've got people around them. And I think it's a great point, you know. So we have this idea about social isolation that it's the bloke in the corner who can't talk to anyone and he's by himself and he's just inherently lonely. I think there's really good evidence that you can be socially isolated in a big, powerful job with people around you and feeling quite disenfranchised and just disconnected from everything that's around you, and it could even be at home in relationships as well. So social isolation it's one of those things that when a guy gets into that space and really becomes disconnected, there's such a heightened risk for self-harm.
So there has been some previous research done about men and mental health. What kind of made this study unique, or what did it add to the conversation?
For me, it was unique because it was Canadian sample, and we used an online panel for this one, and the respondents they were representative in terms of, if you took the census data, this sample was actually reflected the census data. So that's good, because when you get into quantitative numbers, it's nice to know that you've got a group who are broadly representative of a Canadian population. Because oftentimes when we poll people in, say, downtown Vancouver, we might get a particular slant on something, or we might be better educated in something, or we might be more challenged by something. So that was good in terms of sample. I think what was interesting too is it's one of the few studies that's actually asked people about stigma in relation to men's depression and suicide. So oftentimes we go, let's look at stigma about mental illness, and we don't really name it as depression and suicide. We don't really name it as being particularly about men. So we were able to get a sex comparison. So we were able to get a comparison of what women said about men's depression and suicide, and also what men said about it. And I think that's helpful, because it helps us think about interventions that might be tailored to men, you know, so, and some of the things that they might grapple with. So even the finding that guys are tough on themselves in particular, and then there was another finding that women had a kind of a better insight to guys isolating around suicide. It just kind of helps us think about, okay, so what public awareness would we do? Who would we target? Who do we need to be targeting? So I think it was neat in that way. It was a good study in that way. Of course, you know, parochial about our own work, no doubt. But nonetheless, it was a good moment, yeah.
So you're the lead investigator of UBC's Men's Health Research Program. Why is this particular work and topic so important to you?
Well, I started out as a clinician, and the things that I saw didn't quite gel with me in terms of, you know, guys almost looking discordant around their behaviours and what they were saying, you know, so I was kind of became interested in that way. And then to be able to move it into a research paradigm is, you know, just more luck than anything else. And we've been fortunate enough to be strongly supported by a whole bunch of people, including Movember, most recently, to do work where we're trying to kind of message men in ways that will advance their health. And just to say that we've always done it in a relational kind of way. We always felt that if we could make a difference to a man's life in terms of his health, the flow-on benefits would be great for everybody around him. So even though we're doing men's health, and we name it as men's health, I actually like to think that we're doing women's health, we're doing family health. If we do well with men, we do well with everybody, because we know, I often talk about gender relations, we know it just intersects. You know, when a guy's at home with depression and he's got a family, we know that it has implications for that family. We know a suicide has implications for that family. So again, we're just trying to make a difference in the guys' lives, but we know that we can get good flow on it.
Thank you, Emily. Now we have a News 101 correspondent, Evu Gwensen's interview with UBC researcher Dr. Julian Davies about BC First Nations clay that is killing bacteria that happens to be untreatable with antibiotics.
Professor Julian Davies is the principal investigator at UBC's Davis Lab in the Life Sciences Building. Last week, Professor Davies and his lab made an exciting discovery. They found that a clay used for hundreds of years by the Heiltsuk First Nation had remarkable antibacterial properties. The rare clay comes from a 400,000-ton deposit in Kissimmee Bay and was formed nearly 10,000 years ago during the last ice age. The Heiltsuk First Nation has been using it for centuries, eating it to treat stomach ailments like ulcers and applying it directly to burns and other skin irritations. Professor Davies sat down with me to explain what it is exactly that has now been uncovered by his lab.
Well, the thing is, we published a paper, my gosh, it was just this week.
A lot's happened.
Yes. The moment the paper came out, the press releases were released. It was something that surprised me, and the total response.
Did you have any ideas about what you might find when you started?
No idea whatsoever. It was important in beginning because we found, you know, we did find that the leachates killed a lot of bacteria. But the most interesting thing is that they kill resistant bacteria. They kill antibiotic resistant bacteria. It was only recently that we started to do work on multi-drug resistant strains, which were a major problem in hospitals.
Why is that?
They're untreatable. They're completely untreatable. And thing is that in hospitals, and particularly in surgical wards, they use a lot of antibiotics. The idea being that the surgeons don't want to lose patients. And so they use a lot of antibiotics, but it turns out the antibiotics don't always work. And
what happens when they don't work?
The patient dies.
So was there one moment where you realized how significant this could be?
Well, I think, we thought it was significant beforehand, but once we found that the escape pathogens were all susceptible, then we knew we had something.
How did that feel?
Well, it felt very good. I mean, I shouldn't say just very good, but we felt that the clay really had potential.
What's it been like for you, kind of this whirlwind of attention?
No, I think it's awful, honestly.
Why?
We published the paper because we were convinced by the results and we believed it would be interesting. But I had no sense that it would be... I mean, I've had hundreds of emails, and a lot of them are real crackpots, obviously.
But what do you mean by that?
Well, they write... Well, there's somebody who wrote and said they want to use it on elephants, things like this. I'm serious.
How does the attention make you feel going forward with the research?
Well, I'm definitely going forward with it, and we definitely want to do more, and we know, and we'll be getting more money so that we can do the kinds of things, you know, to find out really why the clay is working, and you know, to extend the collaboration with Loretta Lee. I think it's great, and it'll keep us busy for a while, but I'm not interested in building up a huge lab or anything like this. I'm happy with the people I have. I might want to add another technician or something for a while. But I don't, I'm not fond of publicity. First of all, we don't know why the clay is active. What is the active principle or principles? And in general, you know, every country has their Food and Drug Administration, and they want to know how a product works before they use it. Well, we don't know how this stuff works. And they also want to know its composition, and we don't really know the composition. We're working on it, and we're working on it now with some people with the right kind of instrumentation so that we can hopefully find things. But But we decided to go ahead and publish it, and people are interested, and now they want to really work on it and find out what's there, which is a great help to us, because we're not... I was trained as a chemist, but I'm not a chemist now. I'm a biologist.
So what are those next steps, then, chemists?
Oh, next step is to do high-resolution mass spectroscopy and NMR spectroscopy, a variety of modern methods to try to identify what the components of the clay and what the components of the leachates really are.
Okay.
And now, hopefully, when we get to know what the components are, we could perhaps even create a synthetic version of the clay, which would be really good. We have to have a company that is interested in doing it. The Kissimmee clay people can't do it. They're not a pharmaceutical company. But in my opinion, either somebody forms a company that will develop the clay for pharmaceutical purposes, for real treatment, or...
That was my segment with Professor Julian Davis. Now we have News 101 financial reporter Alex Norman's weekly financial report.
This is the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets. These are this week's top stories. Chinese investor group to buy the Chicago Stock Exchange. Too many toys? Mattel Hasbro's fate rides on antitrust review. Shares for LinkedIn plunge on weak numbers. and Lowe's aims to take a bite out of Home Depot's Canadian sales. We begin today's news that the Chicago Stock Exchange, one of the oldest exchanges in the United States, has announced today that it is a planned sale to an investors group led by China's Quanjing Cassian Enterprise Group. The parties did not release the terms of the deal, which is expected to close in the second half of the year. The Chinese investor group officials released a statement saying that, quote, "Together we have a unique opportunity to develop financial markets in China over the long term and to bring exciting Chinese growth companies to U.S. investors." If regulators approve the deal, this would be the first sale of a U.S. exchange to investors from China, but not to a foreign entity. A unit of Germany's Deutsches Boris AG Group purchased the New York-based International Securities Exchange in 2007. Hey kids, have you heard about that new toy deal? Well, news broke today of a proposed merger between Hasbro Inc. and Mattel Inc. The merger could account for close to half the toys sold in the United States. The toy makers would need to win approval from antitrust officials in Washington, who are increasingly saying no to deals marrying dominant players in the industry. Critics against the deal suggest that the antitrust review of Mattel Hasbro will likely focus on narrowing the company's overlaps in specific toy categories, and that makers would likely have to sell off a few product lines to win approval. The combined company would control about 34% of the U.S. toy market. Shares from Mattel Inc. were down today, closing at $31.81 for a 1.49 loss. It's tough times for LinkedIn as share prices plummet on bleak forecasts. LinkedIn Corp's shares plunged today as much as 43%, wiping out nearly $11 billion in market value, after the social network shocked Wall Street with revenue forecasts that fell far short of expectations. The stock sank to a three-year low to $110 in the early trading day, registering its sharpest decline since the company became public in 2011. At least seven brokerage firms have downgraded the stock from buy to hold or their equivalent, saying the company's lofty valuations are no longer justified. An analyst at Mizuho Securities USA Inc. was quoted saying that with the lower growth profile, we believe that LinkedIn should no longer enjoy a premium multiple that it's been grown accustomed to. LinkedIn has been heavily spending on expansion, buying companies, hiring sales personnel, and growing outside the United States, but is now facing pressure from Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and the Asia Pacific due to macroeconomic conditions. Shares for LinkedIn Corp. were down today, closing at $108.49 for a 43.5% loss on the day. Lowe's takes aim at Home Depot Canada. 3 years later, after a tried and failed attempt to buy Rona, the U.S. retailer Lowe's Inc. has reached an agreement to buy the Quebec-based home renovation chain in a deal worth an estimated $3.5 billion. The deal comes at a 104% premium on Tuesday's closing price. If approved, the deal would shift the retail landscape balance powers in Canada. Analysts suggest that this is a signal that Lowe's doesn't see Canada's real estate boom ending anytime soon. Among its commitments to Rona, Lowe's says it has agreed to continue to employ the vast majority of Rona's current employees and to maintain key executives from its Quebec-based chain leadership team. Shares in Lowe's Inc. were down today, closing at $65.84 with a 3.12% loss on the day. In other market news, Toronto's S&P TSX Composite Index fell 0.8% to close at 12,763 points. The broader S&P 500 index fell today with a loss of 1.85% to close at 1,880 points. The NASDAQ closed lower today with a loss of 3.25%. In the European markets, the German DAX closed down 1.49%. In the Asian indices, the market stayed relatively flat as the Japanese Nikkei posted a loss of 1.32% and the Shanghai Composite Index lost 0.63%. In the commodities market, the March gold futures closed up today 1.49% for $1,173 an ounce, while the November crude futures were down 2.32% to close at $31 a barrel. In natural gas, future contracts were up 4.41% to close at $2.06 a unit. In the bond market, yields for 10-year Canadian bonds are currently at 1.153%. U.S. 10-year Treasury yields closed lower today at rates of 1.85%. This has been the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets.
Great, thank you, Alex. For our final segment of the evening, we have a piece from People First Radio with Kevin Midbow and Nicholas Holt. They speak with Derek Book, a consultant in Victoria, British Columbia, and author of the blog Formerly Homeless.
This is a People First Radio podcast.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
Derek Book spent the first 20 years of his life in what he describes as substantial crisis. He was homeless and on the streets at 15 years of age, and went on to spend 5 years in and out of shelters in both Ontario and British Columbia. But Derek found his way out of homelessness and crisis. He went on to become university educated, and he's been working in the field of social work as a case planner, needle exchange worker, homeless count coordinator, and shelter coordinator. Derek Book is the author of an online blog called Formerly Homeless, and he's a tireless advocate for those experiencing homelessness. I spoke with Derek earlier this week.
You were born into what you describe as a multi-generationally broken Métis family in Ontario. How did your childhood, your family situation, lead to your homelessness?
I grew up in a family that we moved around a lot. We probably moved every couple of months. My mother had some really heavy trauma issues, mental health issues that she was dealing with. And, so it caused a lot of disruption in the family. Disruption became the norm. By the time I was 15 years old, the idea of leaving the home was not a big deal in the family, within the family cultural context. So I think what I grew up in, we didn't see home in the same way that other people see home.
You wrote that you were on the streets at age 15. What was that like?
Pretty awful. And I was on the street from 15 to about 20 off and on. I got involved in some programs here and there. In fact, I was in supportive housing for a couple of months as well. But nothing was really sticking, and I was quite lost. I didn't really know what I was trying to do. Didn't have any supports or family or places where I could go. So I traveled around a lot. I was quite a transient homeless person. I would go from, Ontario to Calgary to Kelowna, BC to Vancouver. I sort of had this circuit of places that I would go to and stay in the shelters, sometimes outside. There were very brutal, brutal times out there, when I was alone, lying there on a piece of cardboard in the parkade, not a great feeling at 16 or 17 or whatever. And mostly my problem was with the people around me that were, just walking by or just didn't seem to care. It took me a long time to deal with that, those emotional feelings around that. Yeah, it was quite a difficult time. It seems like a very distant memory because we're going back to 1985 to 1990, so it's a long time ago, but some of the things I feel like they were yesterday.
Your recovery seemed to have occurred in stages. It was a process. It began with the impact, as you've written, of the Native Friendship Center and one particular outreach worker. Tell us more about how you exited homelessness and addiction, for that matter.
Anybody who's been through recovery can say this. They can look back and they can say, there was that teacher in the third grade. In fact, I think all of us can point to those people in our lives that made those impacts. I think sometimes people don't realize when they're going through the world in a way that trying to be helpful, that they're having an impact that they don't even realize they're having. And this guy, this counselor that I mentioned in the piece from the Friendship Center, he was, just an outreach worker. I don't even remember the guy's name, which is really, embarrassing, because a lot of the dialogue that we had set the path for how I was going to think in the future. And, I was just about to turn 20 or something like that around that time. So it was just before I finally got off the street for good. He was just going through his day. And I think those that are helping others don't realize sometimes the impact and the changes that they're making that are really incredibly positive. I wish I could find that guy and tell him. But I think, yes, recovery does happen in stages, and it happens through some inspiration as well. You find those people, and they just get you to that next level of understanding.
You specifically mention the Victoria Life Enrichment Society, and you describe it as being progressive and evidence-based. Tell us more about that experience.
That was a really big one. So that happened around when I was around 25. I got off the street when I was 20. And I worked in the trades for a couple of years, and different dead-end jobs. And then I went into this treatment center, and I decided I was just going to quit everything and deal with my addiction. You know, it wasn't really an addiction thing for me. That wasn't the biggest focus in my life. It was more emotional. It was more about the abuse that I had suffered as a child and just, you know, the wreckage from the past. But the treatment center environment allowed me to explore that. And this treatment center was, you know, most of these people were master's level, client-centered, you know, kind of Rogerian, existential counseling, kind of choice-based. It wasn't solution-focused. It wasn't looking for outcomes. It wasn't behaviorism or cognitive therapy. It wasn't like a training sort of program. There was definitely some educational components, but they were more about educating ourselves on who we were. And it allowed me to pretty much establish and get through a lot of that pain. And it was a month long of really intense therapy. It allowed me to get through a lot of that pain that I was feeling and really embrace my choices that I was making. And at that point, you really don't have any choice but to take responsibility, ironically, you know, because you're now looking at and you're seeing, wow, these hands are actually shaping my life. But it was a very, very gentle program. It was very respectful. It was very dignified. There was the understanding that people that were there were only temporarily ill and they would be getting better and they were just like anybody else. And I think that was a really crucial part of that program.
In an article you wrote recently in the Times Colonist, an op-ed article called Housing the Homeless is a Good Investment, you say the goal is also very simple. When people get housed, they get better. But you also remind readers, housing people doesn't necessarily erase the problems. What do you mean by this? And tell us more about that.
I mean, it's definitely not just a house. No, I want to be cautious here because I want to say that housing first, in other words, the concept of going up to somebody on the street and giving them a set of keys and then supporting them to move into a place is very successful. It's a very wonderful program. To say that people still need supports, often we interpret that or we interpret it as we need to support these people and get them ready for housing. So we even have programs called Ready to Rent, for example. So there's this concept that when you're on the street, you're not ready. Obviously, people need support, but without an address, without a headquarters to operate from, it's impossible to move forward. But the concept that I see in the way Housing First works is you get a person into an address, and then you apply the supports. So you've given the person the keys, you say, okay, do you want some help moving your stuff? You know, the person may feel they have some social anxiety, they may feel a lot of things. There may be some past trauma, there may be some addiction issues, but it's a lot easier if that person has a location that they're operating from that they feel is their own. It allows them to own their own experience.
So in other words, you're not suggesting that you hand people keys and then walk away.
Definitely not. I think what we need to do with the system in general is move the people from shelters and transitional programs into supportive housing positions. So the employees that work in the helping field, a lot of them are running around putting Band-Aids on things. What I'd like to see in the future is those outreach workers working with housed people, concrete positive plans for their life. I think that's a way better use of resources and a way more compassionate thing to do as a society than to make eligibility requirements and decide that a certain part of the population is not eligible. I think that's counterproductive.
You wrote on your blog about the pros and cons of self-disclosure. So you find yourself in situations in which you can self-disclose or you may not. But you say that we survive by ending the silence. Tell us more about your experience of self-disclosure in the work that you do now.
I would say that I have survived in my own life by ending the silence. In other words, by sharing what happened, being able to face what happened, and I also help people in my community by ending the silence about what they're experiencing. So what that sometimes leads to is, you know, I'm in some meeting with leaders in the industry about homelessness and what we're going to do, and I might bring in a personal story. Well, I always found this. And it may seem to some people that that's unprofessional or that's an overshare. And I have a little blog post on this. You know, I've got a little picture of overshare there. And I sometimes feel like that. I feel like I'm so willing to discuss it. And some people feel uncomfortable with that. But for the person with lived experience, our reason for sharing is survival, essentially, and improvement and working forward in the world. We can't fix this unless we look at it because homeless people are invisible, the cure is visibility, and the cure is speaking up. For me, that's what I find. Obviously, people need to disclose as they're comfortable, and there are disadvantages to over-disclosing. In some cases, there can be repercussions, but in general, I embrace the idea of sharing in my life, and that's part of my healing.
You've assisted in getting hundreds of homeless people into addictions or mental health treatment and hundreds more into affordable housing arrangement during the course of your career. Derek, what is it that all of these hundreds of people hold in common?
I would say they're like me, you know, and I think that's the mentality that we need to go forward with on homelessness. That is us. Those people that we think are somehow different are not so different. They're people who have experienced some pretty awful circumstances, but they are not, when given the chance, when given an opportunity, when people listen and when people come to understand them and connect with them, they just get better. That's what I find. You know, and I worked for about 12 years in this industry, and yeah, it's hundreds that I've seen, and, you know, so many different successes. But of course, and of course, as part of the team in, say, a shelter, you know, like I worked at Rock Bay Landing. It wasn't just me at Rock Bay Landing. It was so many hardworking, wonderful people watching these lives improve. You almost, once you start to really listen to a person, once the person really connects with you, it's like you just have to get out of the way because they have a natural plan for how they want to deal with this. So it's more of an honorable journey of watching somebody just get better, just by connecting with them, just by hearing them, just by allowing them to share their story.
Derek Book, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Okay, thank you, Kevin.
Derek Book is a social worker and a tireless advocate for people experiencing homelessness. He blogs online at housecanada.blogspot.ca, and he's on Twitter at BookDerek.
People First Radio is an initiative of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and broadcast on CHLY 101.7, radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the partnering organizations. Listen to People First Radio.
Thank you to People First Radio for that story. That's our program for today, February 5th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email us at news@citr.ca.
You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/radio/news-101. You can also find great content on our SoundCloud page. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Michael Ruffalo.
And I'm Eva Uguensenge. Today's broadcast was produced by Leo Coelho. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening.
Stay tuned for Lady Radio from the Women's Collective right here on CITR 101.9 FM. To close off the show, we have Comfy Cotton Shoes by Moss Lime. Their LP, Zoo du Québec, is currently number 6 on CITR's Top 30. Comfy garden shoes.